Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel, we are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Welcome to Star Trek From the Holodeck. Today, Dave and I are going to be discussing and breaking down the Star Trek documentary, What We Left Behind, looking back at Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Everything is a go, Captain.
Yeah. We are walking the promenade hand in hand. I am Bashir, and David is Garrick.
Hey, I can live with that. Garrick's cool.
And we are skipping.
Secrets. Always keeping secrets.
All right. So you and I were lucky enough to have screening tickets for this documentary. Going into this, I really didn't know what to expect. I am not a big fan of documentaries, and I'm even less of a fan of documentaries that are based on geek franchises, because there's a lot of inside jokes, a lot of wink wink. Basically, you have to be a fan of the franchise if you are to understand and enjoy the documentary. And by the very definition of what a documentary is, you should learn something. When watching the documentary, you should be able to understand whatever content the director is wishing to explore and dissect without already having a knowledge of the content. A documentary should not be a glorified convention.
Yes.
It shouldn't be a glorified Star Trek convention, a Star Wars convention, a Doctor Who convention. It should be able to stand on its own merits and teach people about the content or whatever the director wants to get into.
Mm-hmm.
And David, this documentary did just that. And that's why I was pleasantly surprised with what director Ira Steven Burr and David Zappone did with this. There were definitely some fan exclusive moments, like the hypothetical season 8.
That was actually really cool.
That was explored throughout the documentary, but there was a wealth of insight behind the social relevance and cutting-edge serialized narrative of DS9's 7-year run.
Yes. And the thing was, I went into this just like you with very low expectations, but the one thing that did dawn on me watching this documentary was the fact that out of all the Star Trek series out there, DS9 is probably the one series that has kind
that's
of like
grossly underrated even to this day.
Grossly underrated, yes, but also it's the only series with that, when you look at it, that doesn't have a valid ending. Like we saw the season finale
about?
The season finale for What We Left Behind, right, still had they made it clear that basically they still had a lot of juice left in that.
Okay,
yeah, they had left.
That's fair. I don't want to take the word valid out of there, because the ending was
good.
Yeah, but it was left open ended.
You could tell
that's
that
probably
basically
what you meant to say.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was still open ended to the point that Ira could have actually gone to a season 8.
Yeah,
and it really is a shame when you take a look at it that DS9 was not given its due at the time,
mm-hmm.
because Next Generation got a conclusive ending that felt good for that series. So did Voyager.
I think a lot of people, Dave, just live in the past. And that's a problem that we see even today with Star Trek Discovery and any other iteration of Star Trek. And it is not just Star Trek, just shows in general. People feel like everything should be the same. Oh, it's not what this was like. This is like this. It should be like this. But then why do you want something to regurgitate or retread on similar topics or even similar writing or similar story, similar archetypes? We've already seen it.
Why redo it?
A spinoff or a continuation within a franchise should be slightly different. You got to keep to the themes and ideology, but everything should be different. Everything should stand on its own. And Dave, you and I, we plan to go through all the highlights of this documentary. There's going to be no real spoilers, but we will share what we can and we'll be very careful. I don't want to give away too much because I really want our listeners to buy or rent the documentary when it comes to Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because
later this year. Oh, man, it is very worth it. I'm going to purchase it, but we will do our best to skirt the line. Dave, give me your initial thoughts on the documentary in a nutshell without spoilers.
Initial feelings about the documentary was I had low expectations for it, as I said, because for the longest time now since we started this show, I was on the side, I hate to say it, that DS9 was not my favorite series of all time.
It's because you're a loser.
But ever since that time,
that was a little harsh. The audience might say, "Michael, that's harsh." Fuck them.
I honestly feel that the documentary tackled that, where there was a fan base, the fan base did not accept DS9 for the longest time.
The way they opened up the documentary, Dave, is by
reading hate mail.
Not much has changed, because it's essentially what Jimmy Fallon has people do on his show, where they read the hate tweets.
Yeah.
A lot of the complaints that they were reading, the hate mail, holy shit, it's verbatim of what we see on Twitter and Facebook when they're talking about Star Trek Discovery. It's just the same arguments and complaints. Yeah.
And then, but as the documentary went on, and at this point, I've actually rewatched all of DS9, and I actually do think that I basically just missed the boat on DS9 the first time I watched it.
And you know why I think that is, Dave? Is because you've rewatched it throughout the years through a more mature lens. When it was out in the 90s, you were a kid and you had your own idea of what Trek should be. But as you matured and grew and you have gone into the film industry and you understand the nuances of writing and character development and theme, you have now realized, holy shit, this might be one of the best Treks.
Well, not only that, but I do agree with one of the statements that Ira made at the tail end of the documentary, which was DS9 was the type of show that was 20 years too late or 20 years earlier.
Yeah, a brilliant statement.
Than what the audience was expecting. I was part of that audience that just wanted an episodic type of show.
And that's because you're a loser. And yes, that's harsh.
That's harsh.
But fuck them.
But nowadays, the audience now would have accepted a serialized Star Trek show.
I agree. And not to say audiences didn't eventually get won over. They eventually came.
It took time.
It did take time. I struggled with the opening season, not because it was bad. It just takes time. I think that's with all the Star Trek, except maybe the original series. TNG took 3-4 years to really get going.
Yeah, to get their footing.
We saw the same thing with Enterprise, and it was too late because they were canceled.
It was way too late.
Deep Space Nine, Voyager. Voyager started strong, then meandered a bit, and then found themselves again. Deep Space Nine struggled for, some people say, 2-3 years. I don't feel like they did. The whole Dominion idea was introduced, I believe, in season 2. And that was their foundation. They were building towards this grand serialized narrative that ended up working in their favor. But you're absolutely right, Dave. What Ira said about them being 20 years too early is effing spot on.
Was effing spot on.
Yeah.
That's why I said I had very low expectations for the documentary, but I was pleasantly surprised and actually loved the documentary at the end.
Yeah, I didn't have very low expectations, like you said, but I didn't have the highest expectations just because I feel like in 20 some years of Star Trek, you know, conventions, what more do you need? What more are you going to learn from a documentary?
Exactly.
Because all of these people talk about these things at the Star Trek conventions. But we did learn quite a bit, and we're going to get into that. Now, let's get into the official press release for What We Left Behind. Looking back at Star Trek Deep Space Nine is a documentary taking a retrospective look at Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Its impact, meaning, that's key right there. That's the most intriguing part for me. And legacy. The documentary is produced by 455 Films and directed by Deep Space Nine showrunner Ira Steven Burr and David Zappone. Shout Studios will release the film. The documentary also features several of the writers breaking the story of a hypothetical eighth season of the series, which we will not spoil. Working with CBS Digital, scenes from all seven seasons have been remastered in high definition. Now, don't think, oh, all seven seasons are now remastered.
Are you kidding me?
I would spend $1,000 for that, though. Listen, if someone said, give me $1,000 and you can have a completely high def version of Deep Space Nine, Dave, I'd do it. You can't put a price tag on that. But don't get so excited because we didn't get an entire seventh season. They didn't use this documentary to announce that we are now remastering Deep Space Nine. However, if this documentary does good, Dave, I can't imagine CBS saying, nah, pass.
Exactly.
They're going to say, shit, this documentary just made some dough. Maybe there is a profit in remastering. Now, this remastered high definition was roughly about 20 some scenes. And Dave, that was the biggest reason why I was adamant about seeing this in the theater on the big screen. Firstly, how many opportunities do we really get to see Trek on the big screen? Secondly, we will probably never see, unless this documentary blows the hell up, see DS9 remastered because of the cost.
Oh, yeah.
With a show like this, you're dealing with a lot of optics and visual effects, not just the obvious. And when you go back to the film negative and scan them, like you have to do with this, you essentially have to redo all of that. So yes. Basically, you're doing post-production
all over again.
And there was actually a roundtable discussion with the producers after the documentary that went into the process a bit more. They had mentioned that even cinematographer Jonathan West participated during the color processing portion of the remastering. And this part just made me giddy, you know, being a huge cinematography buff. They said you can tell Jonathan West was really happy to finally see his work as he had shot it. Something he had never been able to see ever. I mean, dailies back then were viewed on VHS.
Yes.
So even though he's shooting in 35 millimeter, he never gets to see the true quality. Can you imagine, Dave, doing work as a cinematographer, which we both have?
Yes.
And never being able to see how it was intentionally shot.
That would be a little heart-wrenching for me.
It would break your soul.
It would break my soul.
As an artist, never being... That's like, Dave, a painter, okay? Painting this epic, okay? Just something that represented something important to him, let's say. And once it was painted, he would never see it, and all he was given was a...
postcard.
A Polaroid. Let's make it worse. A Polaroid of his grand work. That's essentially what Jonathan West had to do.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with a show with in my opinion, some of the best cinematography in Star Trek up until, of course, Discovery, which is groundbreaking as well visually. But they had this whole film noir vibe. It was so rich. The colors, the stations, there were so many practical, lights, how they lit the set. It was just this grand set. And to never see such a beautiful set in HD is a fucking crime against humanity.
It is. It is because, like, believe me, if you guys out there take the time to go watch this documentary, you will be shocked, as I was shocked, seeing the difference between...
I mean, the tones, Dave, the gray tones. It's just...
The absolute solid, contrast between colors in the scenes was amazing. And I love the fact that they took the time to actually show this is the difference. We're just not saying this out of nowhere just to make the tech people out there happy.
Yeah.
We want to show you guys this is what we originally shot.
And they did comparisons too. They showed you the difference to it. Between the standard definition and the HD. And it's just, God damn, it's so good.
It looks so awesome.
And I'm in the middle of doing another rewatch because I rotate. I'm always watching Star Trek at some point during the year. I never go more than a week without watching an episode of Star Trek. Typically, I watch them at night before I go to bed. And I rotate. I go from the original series to TNG to Deep Space Nine to Voyager to Enterprise.
Yeah.
And right now, I'm on Deep Space Nine. And those SD standard definition images are just emblazed in my mind. I'm like, God, this looked good on a regular TV back in the day. So I remember it looking great.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, but now you're watching it on these 4K televisions we have in our homes.
And you can tell the difference.
You can see the degradation. You can see that it's just a flat images. The colors are muddy at points. And to be able to see these images in high def on the big screen, Dave, dude, as a fan of Star Trek and of Deep Space Nine, it was a fantastic experience.
It's basically validation of how good we all believe Star Trek looks.
Yeah.
It's validation because, like, when you get a chance to actually see this documentary and you see what their cinematographer was able to pull off with a stylized Star Trek show.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, Deep Space Nine is the only one that actually, when you look at all the series, that basically said, no, we're going to genre-fy it.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be space noir. All the other series was atypical Star Trek.
I would say,
This decided to basically branch off and say, no, we're going to do a different tone.
Yeah.
It's amazing what it would have looked like if they re-released this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the boat that basically I would buy this.
I would
buy the Blu-ray set.
I'm telling the truth, Dave. If they said, hey, let's start an Indiegogo. Let's say CBS just didn't want to do it. So let's say fans united and said, hey, let's start a petition here to get it remastered and we'll come up with the money ourselves to do it. I would definitely pledge $1,000. As long as I knew it would get made, and if it didn't, I'd get my money back. Dude, sold. We need to get Deep Space Nine remastered.
Yeah.
So in addition to remastered sequences, which was roughly about 20 some minutes.
When it was originally supposed to be 5.
Originally, yes. there were interviews with most of the Deep Space Nine cast, as well as reoccurring favorites like Andrew Robinson, which was, of course, Garrick, Mark Alamo, Gul Dukat, Jeffrey Combs, Aaron Eisenberg. It was definitely a treat for the fans. But my favorite, Dave, was Avery Brooks. It's no wonder he was cast as Sisko. He's got charisma for effing days, Dave. I mean, he's cool as hell, right?
Not just charismatic, but he was a brilliant actor. I honestly think that Avery grossly underrated, because he was able to actually. The one thing I didn't realize till that documentary was he directed some of the episodes of Deep Space Nine, and one of the ones that he directed is absolutely one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he was able to direct it and act in it and give one of the most imposing, I'm trying to figure the right word for it, but one of the most powerful performances.
Yeah, dude, that was something I didn't know. They had mentioned, and again, let's not get into it too much.
I don't want spoilers,
but there was a moment in that episode, I'm not going to say which one, where he directed it, and the cinematographer and everyone else on set behind the camera were just let him go because the scene was done.
And he continued on.
He couldn't pull himself out of it. And they all just let him go, because why would you mess up a performance like that? And to see something like that on Star Trek, first off, we already know Star Trek isn't as dramatic as it is now in Star Trek Discovery. Yes, there are some great story arcs. I don't want people ever thinking I'm talking crap, but it wasn't all drama. It wasn't. And when you get those moments like we get from Patrick Stewart in TNG, you get from Avery Brooks in Deep Space Nine, and then we get the behind the scenes story to go with it, you're like, holy shit, now we know why these particular scenes with these particular actors were so good. And there was a condition for Avery Brooks' involvement in this. And I don't, maybe not condition. I guess it was a suggestion that Ira took to heart. And he said, Avery said, let's not make this just a bunch of talking heads. Let's do something really special. And this is how we got the hypothetical season 8.
Yep.
And damn, was this part cool?
Oh, it was. It's honestly my favorite part, because one of the things, I don't want to get into spoilers, is the reaction of Aaron Eisenberg.
Okay, stop.
That was funny. Yeah. It was actually funny.
No, there's no context, Dave. No one knows what you're talking about.
That's because I want to actually make them watch this, because it's worth it. It is worth seeing the cast reaction to the original writing staff.
Well, that's what was brilliant about this, because it's the kind of things you and I love. We were essentially placed in the writing room, and we witnessed the reunion of the top writers of DS9. Of course, Ira, Robert Hewitt Wolfe, Renee Echevarria, Hans Bimler, and then drum roll, please, the one and only Ronald D. Moore, who to this day is one of my absolute favorite television writers. He's up there, in my opinion, with Eric Kripke, John Wirth, and then there's Ronald D. Moore.
Ronald D. Moore, yeah.
And of course, he moved on to a small little show that he was a showrunner for called Battlestar Galactica. Yeah, that small show. And currently working on Starz' Outlander. So to see Ronald D. Moore in the writing room with Ira and the crew, and we witnessed them breaking the story for an 8th season and what could happen, their plan, Dave, was to have... Yeah, we'll share this part. Their plan was to have Section 31 be a big part of the 8th season. And The most interesting part about that for me wasn't just the idea. Yes, that would be, I think a lot of people gravitated to that whole Section 31 storyline that became a big part of Deep Space Nine. But there was a bit of resentment, or at least it sounded like it, from Ira when he brought up Section 31, because he mentioned the movie using it, the Kelvin timeline using it. And he said, it's ours. We invented it. This show, and we're going to use it.
And now, just like I mentioned to you, now when you look at it, now they're doing a Section 31 show.
Well, I would love to see his reaction now, because this was shot before Discovery's second season. I would love to see his reaction now that Section 31 is such a big part of the future of Trek on CBS All Access.
My absolute dream would be if Ira was actually tied to Section 31 Star Trek.
I'm amazed at, I know that CBS has ran like a cat from his cat box after dropping a shit. They have ran from Rick Berman and the Michael Piller days. You know, there's various rumors as to why. I know there was a lot of animosity towards the end with Enterprise and what happened with that show.
Yes.
But that's the reason why. Ira is one of their boys. That's the reason why he's not involved, I'm sure. But, hey, don't hurt creativity for it. Yes, the writing crew for Discovery is amazing, but how fantastic would it be if Ira was a part of it? And the sense of resentment, Dave, is not because he doesn't want people using it. I don't think it's about that, because if anything, if you created something iconic, wouldn't you feel happy? A little bit of validation, if you will. If you know that your idea was so cutting edge and so many people loved it that they're still using it. I mean, that's a great legacy, Dave.
Absolutely.
That's a huge legacy.
Yeah.
In fact, if anything, that's one of the greatest legacies of Deep Space Nine. And I'm going to say overt legacy, because there's tons of great legacies that you can pull from Deep Space Nine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But the fact that they invented Section 31, one of the most popular elements of Star Trek to this day. But it felt like it wasn't about them using his idea. It felt a lot more like
Ira had different plans for it.
No, I feel like it has a lot more to do with the fact that DS9 has never been given the credit it deserves. And this is just more of it.
I agree with that.
How many people like Section 31 and don't even realize that, oh, they started that in Deep Space Nine. And where's Ira? Ira's got no credit for the Kelvin movies. He's got no credit for Star Trek Discovery. The writers haven't been given credit for anything being done in Discovery. Gene Roddenberry is always remembered and applauded. But Gene Roddenberry had nothing to do with Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
It was Ira. And I feel like the resentment that I can sense in the documentary when he mentioned specific things, it wasn't just this. There's other moments as well. But all of it's connected to one thing. The fact that this fucking show has never gotten the credit or the accolades it rightfully deserves. It never has.
And,
and even today, when more people have managed to understand the show, absolutely, there's definitely been a change, like you, Dave. There has been a change. And more people have managed to understand the show and what they were doing. It's still not given the credit it deserves from the academic community. When it comes to the social relevance of the show, they were doing things in this show that no one was doing.
I'm glad you brought that up because I don't know if do you mind if I actually spoil this one thing? Because it is one of the most important things about this. There was a lot of stuff being said in this documentary, but one thing that stood out to me was they brought up the fact that they did a show that showcased a African-American character.
Just say black dude. Come on.
Yeah, a black character.
A black male.
And it never got the credit it deserved from the TV show, from TV snubs.
Yeah, Ira specifically mentioned a piece from a CNN broadcast
show,
where they were actually talking about the lack of black family leads in shows and the lack of representation.
That was called the 90s.
Yeah, you know, in the 90s. And Deep Space Nine was not even mentioned. This is the biggest reason why Avery Brooks loved his time on the role, and role, I should say, on Deep Space Nine. It was because of the positive relationship between a black father and son. This is something that they discussed in the documentary. Avery said that this is a serious issue within black communities, the grossly disproportionate households where there is no black male role model or father. And he felt like Deep Space Nine was a great example of an intimate relationship between a black father and son.
And if you rewatch this series, you see that with the story of Jake and his father. It's a very close relationship, and it is a very believable relationship between a father and a son.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of love, and that shows just how great Avery Brooks is as an actor. And even what's his name, Sirach Lofton? Jake's name, but
because you hate Jake.
You know what? I'll be honest, Dave. I gained a lot more respect for him after watching this documentary, and not the actor, but the character, because you could see how much chemistry the two of them had on the set. They showed a lot of behind the scenes, and you could see how, you know, Avery Brooks viewed this actor that played his son like a son.
Like a son.
And because of that, it helped with the chemistry of the show. And I feel like Avery Brooks did that for a lot of reasons. So he probably wanted to give Sirach Lofton something that possibly he didn't have in his life. Okay. Because obviously, a strong black male role model is something that's very important to Avery Brooks. And he wanted to bring that across in the show. So I totally understand why Ira does come off, in my opinion, a bit pissed off during the documentary. This show laid the groundwork for amazing, amazing social commentary. A single season never went by without something important being stated.
Yes.
I mean, not to mention, you know, gay relationships, and they've gone.
Well, he says he still regrets that.
I don't agree. I know he said in the documentary that he feels like they could have done more, that they only had one gay kiss between Jadzia and I forgot the character's name. But I disagree with that. The entire character of Jadzia, the Trill, was a way to explore transgenders before transgender rights was even in headlines like it is today. This is why this show's 20 years too early, Dave.
Early.
Ira doesn't even realize the gold mine he was on when it comes to social commentary. The fact that Jadzia was a man, a woman, And she struggled with, I don't want to say struggled, but her identity wasn't about gender. In a lot of ways, her identity was genderless.
Genderless, yes.
It's amazing what it says. The characters, and we've said this in our Patreon discussions, which people can find on patreon.com/RainmanDigital. We've gone into the reasons why the Trill species is amazing and what it said at that time in the 90s, exploring subtly, because that's what you had to do in the 90s. You couldn't be as overt with it. That's why that idea with Jadzia's character being a Trill was a great way to explore the ailments that transgenders may go through, or possibly even identity issues. So I disagree with Ira. I know he's the showrunner, but I disagree. There's things that they were doing, and that's something that a lot of writers have said before. I'm talking showrunners that have listened to our discussions on their TV show, Dave. They've sent me messages. They said, you know what? You find things in my writing. You find things in my writing that I didn't intentionally put there, but subconsciously, it was there. I was trying to explore certain thoughts, and you made me see that. So Ira probably doesn't even realize what they were doing. If you're a progressive individual, like Ira obviously is,
yes,
you have all types of thoughts in your head. And sometimes as a writer, you're writing those thoughts. Think of it as like a web, you know, a mind web where you have different ideas and you're trying to form thoughts.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't know exactly what you're doing, but it's there.
And plus there has to be a little give and take, because you just can't give all your thoughts. You have to be smart with it. You have to be strategic about it, because like if he was to just throw out another relationship, it would take away from what he was talking about with Jadzia.
It would water it down.
It'd water it down. Yeah.
You have to be strategic
with your writing.
Yeah, especially in the 90s. It's a very different time. You have to be strategic if you're hoping to get it past the censor boards. In fact, I believe Terry Farrell, who played Jadzia, even mentioned that during that lesbian scene, they mentioned about putting a warning.
Yeah, she got questions from parents asking how they can actually explain to their children.
It's very easy to explain. Like, all right, some people like the opposite sex and some are born another way. They like the same sex. You explained it. Simple.
Simple.
How easy is that to explain?
Yeah. And it's amazing.
I still remember when my son asked me, we were watching Arrow, I believe, and he saw the character. Who's the gay dude in that show with the curly hair? The Olympiad. I always forget his name. Mr. Terrific. And my son's all, oh, that's an ugly woman, because he was kissing a man. I want to say he was like 7 or 8. And I said, that's a man, son. And he's all, oh, well, that makes sense then, because he's kind of ugly for a woman.
He's ugly for a woman.
And he's all, why is he kissing a man? And I said, well, son, some people like men. Some people like the opposite sex and some people like the same sex. And he's like, oh, it was over with.
Easy. It's easy.
Very simple.
Very simple. And the amazing thing, too, was the fact that not only was Ira able to take on those social questions, but he was able to do other social issues.
Yeah.
Homelessness. The homelessness one I forgot about. And I was like going, oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Dude, that was a huge thing. This show didn't hold back.
But this is something that we talk about a lot in our Patreon discussions.
Yeah.
Where we get into the ins and outs of different Trek themes. And we've praised DS9 for years. And not to say that TNG didn't do it. They absolutely did. The original series did it. All of Star Trek did it. But DS9 doesn't get the credit. That's why we're emphasizing DS9 right now. That's why this documentary is so effing important. But we praised DS9 for years, and to see our words, Dave, prove correct in this documentary feels like a bit of a win for us as well.
It does.
How many times did I look at you?
Validation.
How many times did I look at you during the screening? I'm like, we said this. We've said this.
Yes. Yeah.
We should have been brought on to the documentary. Shit.
We've been saying this for years.
Yeah.
Since we started.
But this is why I get angry, Dave, off topic for just a moment. This is why I get angry with how Discovery is touted as this progressive juggernaut that is changing the Trek game. People, simmer down.
Simmer down.
The folks at Discovery are doing a great job. but you're just doing what you're supposed to be doing when you write Trek. If you weren't doing it, people would be throwing tomatoes at you.
Yes.
Star Trek is progressive. It has always been. And that's the only thing that kind of gets me annoyed with Discovery, because you see all these people, some of the actors. Oh, this is what we're doing on Discovery. I'm like, how old are you, 30? Have you tried to rewatch Star Trek? They've been doing this before you were born. They were doing this before I was born. They were doing this.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not an old man by any means. Late 30s. But I remember. So it gets under my skin. And if it gets under my skin, Dave, imagine what's happening to Ira. Like, oh, man, we've been doing this shit for years. First, you steal Section 31 from me. I get no credit.
I tackle all the social issues that you guys were afraid of.
And then you're pretending you're the first ones doing it. It's easier for you guys. It is, Dave. That's another thing. It's great that Discovery is doing it, but it's far easier in this landscape, social landscape, than it was 20 some years ago.
Yeah, it is. That's the difference, is the social landscape of the two shows, because like Discovery nowadays, we're more socially acceptable than we were back in the 90s.
At least most of us are, but there are people that just pretend as well.
That just pretend. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So another real moment I totally connected with was Terry Farrell's bit, talking about her death scene.
Oh, dude. And I was kind of wincing when they were like talking about this, because it's a very social subject.
It was awkward.
It was an awkward subject.
Even when she was talking to Ira about it on film, you could tell he was wiggling in his chair. But they essentially recast Dax. That's what they did for the final season. It was a pretty heart-touching and enlightening moment in the documentary. I had always heard that she wanted to move on. That's what I heard. I always heard that she wanted to move on and do that show with Ted Danson.
Yes.
That's what I always heard. I remember reading trades. In fact, I have them in my storage. I have trades where they talk about her moving on. It's time for her to move on. But we hear from her point of view. She was essentially strong-armed and pushed out due to contract negotiations. It was a whole, like, take-it-or-leave-it mentality. And I know some of this has been mentioned throughout the years at conventions and different interviews, but to hear it in an official capacity and to see Terry's reaction as she recites her side of the story, and she's in tears, crying. She didn't want her character to be killed, and that's what meant so much more than anything, Dave.
Oh, yeah.
That made me love her character even more and love her as an actor, because it wasn't about leaving a show. It was about what they did to her character. She says, I didn't want her to die. I didn't want her to die.
Yeah.
She wanted everything to work out, and she was basically pushed out. And she even said that an executive at Viacom at the time told her that she should be happy with what she gets, because if it were not for this job, she'd be working at Walmart.
Yes. And the thing that really, for me, that was kind of like a sore subject when I was watching the documentary, was because even when you watch the episode where Dax dies, it's so abrupt and happens.
Yep.
Just like that. And then
I never got resolved, Dave.
You never get resolved.
I mean, and they gave us resolve by essentially recasting her. And that's why I never got into Esri Dax.
Yeah.
I mean, in retrospect, when I go back and watch, I'm okay with her. But at that time, Dave, I could not like her character. I was like, you recast a character, and yes, you have this great plot device called a Trill, where you can just essentially create the same character and create some conflict between, you know, with Michael Dorn's character, Worf. It was great. It shook up the chemistry, or the dynamic, I should say. It shook up the dynamic of the crew. But do we really need to shake up the dynamic of the crew during its final season?
By killing off one of the cast members.
Yes. And to this day, when I watch that episode, it gets under my skin. It irks me. I'm like, God damn it. And now that I know the reason as well, officially, now that it's been stated in this documentary, it sucks even more. I mean, it makes me angry that they, you know, that she left the show because of contract issues. And honestly, I don't blame her. She stood up for what she believed in. No, I deserve this. This is what I deserve.
Yeah, she did what any normal human being would have done.
Especially in today's climate, Dave, because a lot of women nowadays, because of this whole Me Too movement, what do? They move on. Like, this is what I deserve. I want this pay. If I don't get it, you don't have me. So things have changed a lot. And I'm sure that if we were in today's social climate, Harry Farrell probably would have received the money she wanted and that she deserved. And that executive that said she would be working at Walmart would be fired.
Probably. But like the only good thing out of that was the fact that I understand that a lot of there were fans that were very against the character of Esri. But honestly, in the final season, she grew on a lot of fans. They basically
It took some time. I'm not saying I disliked her. It just I didn't know how to feel about it for a very long time.
Yeah. But if it weren't for that, we wouldn't have gotten Esri. And it's kind of like a give and take. And the thing I really did appreciate was the fact that some of the cast members basically said, you know, no one can really take a side at this point, because at this point, it's kind of like looking at a situation where, well, they say this and the other side says this. Whatever happened, it's between them. And I felt sorry for Terry Farrell, because you're right. When she talks about it, you see raw emotion that it still affected her.
Yeah.
That she was like going, she was trying to do what she thought was best, and she got it thrown in her face.
She's rather attractive still.
She is.
Not going to lie. Speaking of that, let's be superficial for just a moment. But every member of the cast, they've aged pretty well. I think Mark Alamo. Is that how you say his name? Gal Dukat. I think he's probably aged the poorest.
The poorest?
But he's also an old man. The dude's old.
Dude, Avery Brooks, though, hasn't aged.
That dude looks the same.
He looks the same.
Black don't crack. They say that for a reason. Yeah, he looks great, dude. Nana Visitor looks great.
Yes.
The actor that plays, I forget his name all the time, Julian Bashir looks great.
Looks great.
Armin Sherman looks great. Terry Farrell looks great. They've aged way more gracefully than the original series cast did. let's be honest. They let themselves go gray and fat really fast. But the Deep Space Nine cast, man, they have aged very well. This is why we need them back in a TV show. Please, let's do it.
Oh, they could. That's why I got really excited about like the writers getting together and they were talking about this is our pitch for the pilot and stuff like that. And I can honestly still see the cast doing this episode that they were talking about.
Can we get something? CBS All Access, give us a goddamn Deep Space Nine movie, something.
It would be nice. It would be really nice. The one thing I want to ask you about was, is that the one sore point for DS9 as a DS9 fan that you have, is the fact that in the very end, we do not know what happened to Sisko.
And because of that, we have never been able to use them in movies or anything else.
Exactly.
And we'll never be able to use them. And maybe that's what he wanted. I was hoping they went into that, like the decision. I know there's been rumors and discussions about why they did that, but I would like to have heard officially in this documentary. And maybe that's something he wanted. Maybe he didn't want his character to be repurposed. He wanted this to be the end for him and his story. And you know what? As an artist, I can kind of see that, because the man's a poet. The way he speaks, the way moves,
yeah,
he looks like a poet, and he thinks like a poet.
Remember what they called him? He was a jazz singer.
Yeah.
He is a jazz singer. And yeah, Avery Brooks is a jazz singer.
Yeah.
Like, he is smooth.
All right, Dave, we need to go to a very quick break, and then when we get back, we will continue our discussion on what we left behind. We'll be right back.
They have given you your answer, Captain. Weapons stations. Fire at will.
What are you looking at, nerd? Huh?
I thought I was looking at my mother's old douchebag, but that's in Ohio.
Geek Out Saturday.
And this is something that Supernatural, I don't think, has ever really had a big problem with.
Right.
All of its monsters, a lot of shows have procedural elements. We've talked about this before on the show.
There's a level of responsibility on his head as someone that is a metahuman and uses his powers for good.
She's force sensitive, but she's not a Jedi.
If you've been watching Rebels, you see that happen.
During a roundtable interview with reporters yesterday, the Flash executive producer Andrew Kreisberg revealed that Kevin Smith's...
However, race is important in the Dark Tower universe, and the relationship between Susanna Dean and Roland centers around the color of their skin.
Catch up on your favorite Rain Man digital geek shows every Saturday. DC on CW, Back to Tank, Weird West Radio, The Crossroads, and more. Geek Out Saturday on Rain Man Channel 001. Listen from the Rain Man digital app or tune in. Just search RM Channel 001.
The Rain Man Show. The Rain Man Show.
Apparently, the whole fabric of society, so long as they and their weird way of doing sex is legitimized. That's what they want.
Their weird way of having sex or doing sex. I mean, gay folk, they're not aliens. They're not from Trisomian 21. They're human beings. They have sex the same way we do. They don't mind meld in order to fuck.
Now then,
they don't place their fingertips together and they're orgasming. The way these, I mean, Thomas.
Jesus, he's in the studio.
Thomas, I mean, the way the gays signed those leases for the latest Kia excursion. I mean, it's just, it's madness. The way they do those leases and buy those homes. And
you mean with the signature the same way everyone else does?
Their credit ratings are just exuberantly high for people.
From a lack of divorce.
It's true. I mean, they live a better life. They have more disposable income than the rest of us. But good golly, they're going to ruin society. If anything, we can learn a little bit about economics and the life savings from the gay community.
For more Rain Man, visit RainManShow.com.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to Star Trek From the Holodeck. If you're tuning in on our 24/7 channel, RM Channel 001, on Geek Out Saturday, you can find all of our shows on demand. Just search Star Trek From the Holodeck on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Leave us reviews, give us thumbs up, share the show. Also, you can help us stay afloat, help us keep the lights on in our holo suites. If you go to patreon.com/rainmandigital and pledge, we have various tier options. $1, $3 for behind-the-scenes pre-shows. We do a lot of pre-shows. Basically, we get the geekiness out before we do our regular broadcast. We talk about whatever. Trek things. Things we're excited about. Patreon.com/rainmandigital pledge. Thank you. All right. Let's continue our discussion on this documentary, What We Left Behind. Now, Dave, I did say that this was a great documentary, and it was.
Yes.
The average doc viewer could flip this on and enjoy it and learn something. But that being said, there were some great fan moments as well, and there needed to be. For example, the intro, the introduction to the documentary. I was wondering what they were going to do. Are they going to start with the Deep Space Nine theme? Even though I'm sure the licensing on that for a documentary or film is ridiculous. But they did a fun little intro that was performed by Max. I believe his name is Grodinchik. Hopefully I said his name the right way. Basically, his name, Rom. Let's just call him Rom.
Rom.
And man, does he look a lot like his character.
Yes, he does.
And I've seen him throughout the years at conventions, but just see him on screen like, you know, without his makeup on screen, I was like, he looks just like Rom. I did like that intro. It was fun to see that little tune that I'm hoping they release on iTunes. That'd be a great way to make more money on this. Release some of those tunes on iTunes, sell them for $1.99. I'd pay for it.
I'd honestly pay for it.
It was fun. They did a little rhyme for Deep Space Nine. Then they did the outro that also involved Max, but also Armin Sherman was there.
Yes.
Jeffrey Combs. And that's how they ended the documentary, with another tune. That classical vibe. It was pretty fun. A little jazz vibe, right?
It was. And it fit what DS9 was. Basically,
especially towards the end.
Towards the end.
With the holosuite program.
With Vic.
Yep.
I love that whole vibe. It was supposed to be a noir type of series, mm-hmm. and that type of music and that type of atmosphere was where it was really cool in DS9.
Yeah.
So for them to actually say, well, I can understand the licensing thing like you brought up. I mean, it'd be really expensive.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, and let's choose between using a theme song we can listen to all the time online or HD scenes. I'm going to go with those HD scenes. Yeah.
And that's why I was like going, I would pay to actually get those little tunes that they did as the Star Trek Rat Pack.
Yeah. It was just so much fun to see that. Also to see the entire cast together on a couch, essentially a round table type discussion where we learn a little bit about the thoughts of our actors. You know, 20 years later, Michael Dorn's casting was a big one for people.
Oh, yeah.
At first, I thought it was for humor, but Armin Sherman straight up said it pissed him off.
Yeah.
When they had brought Michael Dorn on. And he said, not because Michael Dorn, he's all, I love that guy. He's a fabulous actor. He's all, but the character of Worf just got under his skin.
Because
and it wasn't like, just him. It was a lot of the actors like, yeah, because it just kind of invalidated what they were doing on Deep Space Nine.
Exactly.
And they needed to be rescued by a TNG character.
And it was funny because like when they showed that cover that I would say it's iconic for Star Trek fans, that iconic cover of that Star Trek magazine where it says, oh, Worf's in DS9 now. And at the time, I also kind of like was like going, why are they bringing Worf into DS9?
I was excited.
He has nothing to do with this.
But, I was excited.
Okay, let's do it.
I was excited.
Yeah.
I was a kid, though. I didn't really know, you know, what they were doing. But now in retrospect, it was stunt casting. Yeah. And that's what a lot of TV shows did, especially back then. When a show is not where they want it to be ratings wise or enthusiasm wise, what do? They bring in that stunt cast. You know, they help with PR, and it did help bring people into the show. For years, a lot of people said the show found itself once Worf became a part of the crew, but it wasn't Worf that saved the show. It was the fact that they were already building up this story with the Jem'Hadar and the Dominion, and the fourth season is just where it really took off.
Oh, yeah.
It had nothing to do with Michael Dorn. Not to say Michael Dorn was not a great addition, and to this day, I am thankful that Michael Dorn was able to give us several more years of his performance as Worf. And he did help the show. It created a pretty good chemistry, but it wasn't, he's not what saved the show. Maybe it helped with the ratings. Absolutely. We've discussed this on several Patreon discussions, but the show had already found its feet by the ending of season 3 in a lot of ways. And season 4 was just the start of that. You can also tell that Ronald D. Moore, he straight up said he was never excited about Worf's return.
Yeah.
I was like, holy shit, I can't believe you just said that out loud. But he said it during the roundtable discussion or during the writing room, breaking, you know, the 8th season. He said, yeah, I wasn't all too excited. He's always okay with it. He's all, but I wasn't like, oh, yes, Michael Dorn. It's because he and the rest of the writers were very happy with what they were doing and their plans they had for the show. And Michael Dorn wasn't going to change those plans, having him be Worf.
Yeah, because one of the things they pointed out in the documentary that they kind of went into detail about was the fact that DS9 wanted to have different villains. And by bringing in
Dave,
Worf...
How many times do I say this? How many times have I said, give me something new?
Give me something new.
And that's what the writers did.
Yeah, because like all the time we've been talking about Klingons. One of my favorite clips that they showed was the one where Quark goes, oh, great, another Klingon. And like it is basically kind of like what the writers were thinking because they wanted to introduce something new.
Well, that was my problem with Voyager. That was my problem with the first season of Discovery.
Yes.
They retread. Like, okay, well, what worked for TNG? Well, our ratings are slipping. This was Voyager. Let's throw the Borg in. Let's make the Borg a big part of the story of Voyager. And to me, that just never sat well because that was Picard's thing. Those were the villains that made Picard who he is in so many ways. It solidified the characterization of Picard at that moment in the TV show and moving forward into the movies. And when Discovery did it with the Klingons, I'm like, we've already done this.
Yes.
Create some new villains. And of course they did. For season 2 so far. But yeah, that just shows you how innovative the writers were in Deep Space Nine, once again trying to blaze their own path, creating their own characters, and not just one, Dave, the Jem'Hadar, the founders, shapeshifters, and then I always forget the name of the other ones. Shit.
The face of
the Dominion, basically. I forgot their alien species, though, at this moment. But you're right, Dave, and I love that they brought that up, because Deep Space Nine wasn't trying to retread. They were trying to do their own thing. And I think ultimately that's why Deep Space Nine stands the test of time. Because they weren't just trying to retread. Dave, any favorite moments of the documentary that you'd like to share before we close out today's discussion?
Without spoiling?
Yeah.
Without spoiling. We've already discussed that basically the whole writer's room thing was actually a fantastic thing to see. But one particular moment in the documentary that I really do appreciate, because it really shows and it says the hard work that they put into it, was the discussion about the makeup and the prosthetics.
Oh, yeah.
That for me was just validation of just film work in general. Them talking about the long hours, the 16-hour days, the 12-hour days. It's funny to me that basically a lot of people ask about filmmaking lifestyle. And I always tell people, oh, yeah, there's days where it's like 16, 18-hour days. You work that long. And people don't believe it. But it's true. In our industry of filmmaking, that's what it was like when you actually – the actors have to sit there sometimes for hours getting these prosthetics put on. And it is – it's not fun. It's painful. And that's what I really appreciated too, was the fact that the actors really alluded to the fact that while it was painful, they still had fun with it. Make no mistake, they wanted to rip off their face, so to speak, and just throw it at Iris sometimes, because wearing those prosthetics is painful, and it's not the most pleasant thing in the whole world, and it's hard work. You have to expect that as an actor, that basically you're going to be doing these long hours, but the work at the end of the day is so important to get validated. And that's I think in general that the documentary you really got across was the fact that it's a validation for all the hard work and how important DS9 was. That's what they wanted. They just want validation saying that we're not the middle child. We were a good series.
Yeah.
And when you do look back, they were a good series. They deserve to be up there with TNG Voyager.
Forget Star Trek for a moment, but they deserve to be on the top list of sci-fi franchises.
Yeah, sci-fi franchises. Absolutely.
If a Star Trek fan doesn't want to accept it, then the sci-fi fans should.
And I think that's why it's afterwards, I tried to rethink what are my favorite Star Trek series, because when we first started the show, DS9 was near the bottom.
Yeah, because you're a loser.
And now it's kind of like, okay, it's really difficult for me to actually, after rewatching all series and everything, and basically say one's better than the other.
You're hate watching. If you sit down to binge Deep Space Nine and you walk away disliking it still, you're hate watching.
You're prepared to
just dislike it. And that's something Nana Visitor said during the documentary. She said that they have a whole new era of fans. It's insane to see that what 20 years has done, especially with the binge watching viewership, being a thing and people streaming it all in different platforms. It's created a whole new fan base, people that aren't watching it with bias. They're like, wow, this is really good. I can't believe I never watched this before.
Now, this brings up a question that I want to ask you, though.
Okay.
After we've seen the documentary, after me and you have covered Star Trek for a very long time, would you be surprised if the new Kurtzman, do you think Kurtzman would actually say, okay, I succeeded with Discovery. I got Picard coming up. I have a cartoon coming up. I have Section 31 coming up. We want to saturate the market with Star Trek. Would you be surprised if Kurtzman says, okay, let's bring back DS9.
I could see it happening. Yeah, absolutely. Especially because that's Kurtzman's goal, is to saturate.
Is to saturate the
and
market.
Honestly, Kurtzman's style and what he's doing with Discovery, it definitely fits with Deep Space Nine.
Now, I think I'd be happy about that. But yeah. Do you think they could still do it?
I don't know, Dave. I'm more about moving forward, honestly.
Precisely.
Like,
that's
I love Deep Space Nine, and I joke as a fan that I would like to see it. And as a fan, I would like to see it come back, just because I'm talking or speaking as a fan. But as a critic, it's done. The show has been done for 20 years. The story has been told. We need to move forward and track. We can't regurgitate and recycle things. Now, with the Picard series, I feel like it works because of what they're doing, because of the premise.
Yes.
But also, my final thoughts are going to be on hold until I see what they actually do with that show. All right, Dave. So it is time to close out today's discussion. My final thoughts. I loved it. Enjoyed it. It was a good combination of fan moments, true documentary moments, journalist moments, if you will. And it had a great sense of humor as well. It was funny. There were several moments throughout the entire documentary where I was laughing out loud.
Oh, yeah.
It was great. I really, really enjoyed this. I did not expect to enjoy it this much. I feel like everybody should check it out. What We Left Behind, looking back at Star Trek Deep Space Nine, is set for its streaming debut on August 6th, with a physical release in both Blu-ray and DVD formats that same date. I suggest everyone picking up a copy. That ends today's discussion. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.